were the band Transatlantic, and a track written by lead singer and keyboard player Neil Morse about the then recent death of his father. And I think it really sums up the Christian response to going through suffering and pain in life. And it's a perspective we'll come back to at the end, because as your sheets say, I'm going to look at three different types of problem of evil in this talk. I'm going to look at what philosophers call the logical problem of evil, the inferential problem of evil, and what you might call the existential problem of evil, the question of how you actually cope with and get the resources from your worldview or your spirituality to cope with evil. And so I wanted to sort of bookend this with the more existential, although we'll deal with a bit more of the more abstract philosophical argumentation in the middle. Let me just quote some lines from here. So he's talking about the death of his father, and he says, long ago he saw the light of day. His father was a Christian. Then the wind, it blew the man away. And I don't believe I wear rose-coloured glasses, but I believe the man is going home. Long ago he set the ship aright, and then he sailed away into the night. And I don't believe I wear rose-coloured glasses, but I do believe the man is going home. And I know that we are more than dust and ashes. And one day we'll know what we've known. We'll understand what we've gone through. But on the dark side, there are times of suffering. But as the pages turn, one day we'll learn of everything. But now we see through glass. A reference to St. Paul's. But now we see as in a glass, darkly. He talks about saying goodbye and scattering his father's ashes. And the chorus repeats. And then we have over here, this world is not our home. You can live like a rolling stone, but you can't escape with your life. We seek a city of fire with the heart of a child's desire. We will cross that bridge and enter into life, real life. But on the dark side, there are times of suffering. And so you get the Christian worldview's very realistic perspective that there are times of pain and suffering, and that's real and it's tough. But the Christian worldview also says things that give you the resources to face those hard times with hope. And it's a theme we'll come back to at the end. So these are the three problems of evil that we're going to discuss that I just mentioned. And you'll notice I keep coming back to this fantastic painting of the crucifixion as well. One might think that a worldview of spirituality, the central pivotal point of which is a man who was divine being crucified, might have interesting things to say in response to the question of pain and suffering in the world. Let's start with the kind of traditional argument against believing in God from the existence of evil, what's been called the logical problem of evil. And it's basically the claim that the statements evil exists on the one hand and God exists on the other hand are mutually incompatible. To claim that evil and God both exist is like claiming that there is a square circle. It just makes no sense. It's an incoherent claim to make. But are these two claims actually logically incompatible and mutually exclusive? Because the argument depends upon saying that they are mutually exclusive, and that since it's obvious that there really is evil in the world, well then it must be obvious that there really can't be a God. There can't be a God. It's impossible that God exists, given the reality of evil. But philosophers have noticed, even atheist philosophers discussing this, have noticed that simply making the claims evil exists and God exists isn't on the face of it obviously incoherent. It's not as obviously incoherent as stating there is a square circle, is it? You can just see intuitively that if I claim to you there is a square circle, or I claim to you I cannot speak any words of the English language, that those are incoherent claims, they're not true. But if I claim God and evil both exist in this world, it at least doesn't have the same obviousness to it. So people have tried to unpack where this supposed contradiction comes from. We need to be a bit more specific, basically, about what we mean by talking about evil and what we mean by talking about God. As many things in philosophy do, it comes down to the philosopher saying, well, it depends what you mean by. Alvin Plantinga says, many who confidently assert that this set of beliefs is contradictory make no attempt whatever to show that it is. There's a thing here about the burden of proof. If someone says to you, well, you know, it's obvious that there can't be a God because there's evil in the world, why not say to them, well, that's an interesting point of view. Could you give me an argument to show that that is the case? Rather than being on the defensive, just ask them to actually come up with the argument that proves that. Michael L. Peterson says the alleged inconsistency is not obvious, it's not explicit nor formal in nature. To make the purported implicit inconsistency explicit, some additional propositions, statements, truth claims must be specified. And basically, the argument has gone down the road where people have tried to specify what these different propositions are, and perhaps come up with something like this. When we're claiming that God exists, the important thing about this is that we're saying that God is a maximally powerful being who is also maximally knowledgeable. You don't want to leave the get-out clause of, well, you know, God doesn't get rid of the evil in the world because he doesn't know about it. That God is meant to be wholly good. And that God freely created the world. And this claim about evil existing really needs to be the claim that objective evil, the kind of evil that's discovered by us rather than simply invented by us, really does exist. Because otherwise, all you're really saying is there are some things in the world that I don't happen to like, subjectively speaking, but God appears to. And, you know, so what? That's like saying, I like Brussels sprouts and you don't. What does this prove? Not a great deal. So atheist Robin Le Provdon put its argument, the logical form of the argument, about as well as you can, I think, when he puts it this way. He says, look, if God is all-knowing, he will be aware of suffering. If he is all-powerful, surely he will be able to prevent suffering. And if he's perfectly good, he will desire to prevent suffering. Secondly, but clearly, he does not prevent suffering. Three, he thinks it therefore follows that either there is no such deity with all of those qualities, or, if there is some kind of a deity, he is not all-knowing, all-powerful, and perfectly good. Although he may be one or two of these. Neo-atheist Sam Harris uses this argument. He's the only new atheist I can find who actually explicitly uses the logical problem of evil, though. He says, if God exists, either he can do nothing to stop the most egregious calamities, or he does not care to. God, therefore, is either impotent or evil. And a question from the back.
What are that word?
Which one?
Egregious.
Outrageous and really obvious. Sort of huge. Yeah. But notice something very interesting about the way that these two atheists, in trying to firm up the argument, end up admitting something at the end. Notice they haven't come to the conclusion, blah, 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 evil exists, therefore God cannot exist. which was where the argument was originally trying to do. They've come up with either there's no such deity, or there's some kind of deity who lacks at least one of these properties on my list. So the logical problem of evil, which is, let us remember, the most used, the most sort of fundamental, as it were, argument in the quiver of arguments from the atheist camp against the theistic camp, is not an argument for atheism. It's not an argument against theism, the idea that there's some kind of God or supernatural creator of the universe. It's only an argument against a certain type of theism, a theism that attributes certain sets of qualities to God. But it's not an argument against any other type of theism. So it's not an argument for atheism. And it's certainly not an argument for a naturalistic or materialistic view of the world. I think those are very interesting things to draw attention to about what's meant to be the kind of strongest form of the most used argument from the atheist side. Yes, sir?
Well, you mentioned Sam Harris. How would he define what is good, what is evil then?
Yes, okay, a question here about how would Sam Harris define what is good and evil. We'll sort of come back to this topic a little bit, but Sam Harris is particularly interesting. Not only is he the only new atheist to use the logical problem of evil as an argument against some kind of particular kind of belief in God, he's the only new atheist who is explicitly someone who believes that moral values are objective things. Now, I don't think his account of the reality of objective moral values is a good one. That would be a topic for a whole other lecture, but he did a very interesting debate recently with Christian philosopher William Lane Craig, which you can easily find online and on Craig's website, that goes into that. But the other new atheists have, in their work, not been explicit about objective moral values, and certainly some of them have been explicit in saying they're moral subjectivists, which is an issue we'll tie back into. But philosophers, even the atheist ones who have tried to firm up this argument, as it were, tried to make this apparent implicit contradiction that they think they're explicit, they've begun asking questions like, well, is it true to say that an all-good God would necessarily desire to prevent all evil now? Which is an assumption that the argument seems to have to make. Well, atheist Richard M. Gale, for example, says, we often feel justified in bringing about or not preventing some evil so that a greater evil can be avoided, or an outweighing good realised. So atheist Richard Gale says it's not true to say that an all-good being necessarily desires to get rid of all evil. Robin Leprovdon, whose construction of the logical problem of evil we quoted, says suffering may be part of the divine design insofar as suffering is an essential consequence of some greater good. So he recognises that his construction of the argument falls down at this point. J.L. Mackey, who was instrumental in putting forward the logical problem of evil, later came to see that it had some flaws. He said the opposition between good and evil may be construed in such a way that a wholly good God would not, after all, eliminate evil as far as he could. And it may be argued that there are limits. This is going on to the other issue. Are there God's omnipotence or all-powerfulness? That may be argued that there are limits to what even an omnipotent being can do. For example, it would usually be said that God cannot do what is logically impossible. And this, we can agree, would be no real departure from omnipotence. So if it's even possible that it's logically impossible for God to get rid of some evils, particularly if those evils are, say, the means to some greater good or to preventing some greater evil, then God's off the logical dilemma, as it were, because the argument would have to assume that God could do the impossible in order to prove that God would be able to get rid of all evil now. So Mackey concluded, the problem of evil does not, after all, show that the central doctrines of theism are logically inconsistent with one another. Agnostic philosopher Paul Draper says, it is possible that there is some good reason, perhaps a reason too complicated for humans to understand, for God to permit tragedies. So tragedies don't conclusively disprove God's existence. Just the mere possibility that he could have a reason. You don't have to be able to even put forward a hypothesis as to what that reason might possibly be. All you have to note is that as long as it's logically possible that God have a reason for allowing evil, that's a sufficient reason, then you've proven that God and evil are logically compatible realities. So atheist William L. Rowe says, some philosophers have contended that the existence of evil is logically inconsistent with the existence of the theistic God, God defined in this particular way. No one, I think, says Rowe, has succeeded in establishing such an extravagant claim. Indeed, granted incompatibilism, and what he means here is he's talking about granted that the idea that people have genuine free will, libertarian free will as philosophers call it, granted that that's sort of plausible, he says there's a fairly compelling argument for the view that the existence of evil is logically consistent with the existence of a theistic God. And what he's really referring to here is work done by Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga in the 1960s, where Plantinga made this distinction. Philosophers love distinctions. It keeps everything nice and neat and tidy in the sock drawer of ideas. And he said, in response to this objection from evil, you could make a theodicy, that is, from the Latin, an attempt to defend the ways of God to man by giving some explanation of why it actually is that God permits evil and suffering. And you say, well, look, you can understand why there's evil and suffering in God's world because he's doing it for the following reasons. Or it's at least plausible to think that he's doing it for the following reasons. And Plantinga said, well, yeah, that's fine, that's one way to go, but there's another way to go. Let's call it a defence. And a defence is not the same thing as a theodicy. A defence is simply a logically possible account of reality, claiming to show that God and evil can, it's possible, logically speaking, that they coexist. This account that's offered in a defence need not be true in order for the defence to be successful. Maybe it's a false account of how come God and evil could possibly coexist. But so long as you've shown that there is one way in which God and evil could possibly coexist, even if that's not the actual way in which they are able to coexist, you've proven that their coexistence is not logically incompatible. Whereas a theodicy is trying to do a bigger job. It's trying to not only show a possible way in which God and evil fit together, as it were, but it's trying to offer a way that it's plausible to think is the actual way in which they coexist. So this is a much more minimal task, but in terms of rebutting the claim that God and evil can't possibly coexist, a defence is all you need, which is a really good insight. And so Plantinga puts forward what's now called the free will defence. He says, look, think of it this way. A world containing creatures who are significantly free is more valuable than a world containing no significantly free creatures. But to create creatures capable of significant moral good, God must create creatures capable of moral evil. if they're going to be free to choose to do good and thus be morally praiseworthy, and that's a good thing, then of course they have to be free to not choose the good. Because if you're not free to avoid choosing the good, well, then your choosing of the good is not something that you've done freely. And so wouldn't have the value that attaches to freely doing the right thing. And of course, God can't give these creatures this kind of freedom to perform evil and at the same time prevent them from doing so. And that's just a logically incoherent concept, that God would create creatures who have the freedom to do evil, but at the same time ensure that they have no freedom to do evil. That is an obviously, explicitly self-contradictory concept. And then, of course, people might say, oh, okay, that's like human freedom and the evil that man does unto man. What about the suffering caused by the natural world, you know, earthquakes and tsunamis and so on? And here's Plantinga's defence. It's a very interesting move. He says, well, let's just add to our picture the admittedly implausible, but at least logically possible explanation that all natural evil is caused by demons misusing their free will. Okay? Now, of course, within a Christian worldview that does believe in the existence of evil supernatural forces, in a theodicy, one might well appeal to the actions of Satan and his demons as a partial explanation for various bits of evil and suffering in the world. That might be part of a Christian theodicy. But remember, it's a defence that Plantinga is going for here. So he's not claiming this is true. He's claiming, supposing this is even just possible, that all natural evil is caused by supernatural misuse of free will, then we can kind of expand the territory that our free will defence covers to cover everything that needs covering. And that's sufficient to disprove the logical problem of evil.
Yeah. Question to the slide before. when I follow correctly, we want to prove that God and evil are not incompatible, right?
Right.
So when we introduce God as someone who creates, I assume God exists.
Yeah.
Is this assumption legitimate? Is this the right
point? Right. Okay, yeah. You're basically asking, is this argument question begging or arguing in a circle? Because it begins by saying, well, let's suppose there is a God who creates the world in the following way. And of course, this is being offered as a rebuttal to an objection to there being a God. So the question arises, well, are you just sort of begging the question by assuming at the outset of your rebuttal that there is a God? The answer to that is that it's not question begging, because in terms of giving a defence, remember, rather than a theodicy, Plantinga is not saying, let's suppose that there is a God, but rather, let's suppose that it's logically possible that there be a God who creates creatures with free will. And if there, in such a possible world, as philosophers would describe it, which may not be the real world, you know, there may be no real God in the real world, we're just talking about this possible universe. If there were a God who created creatures with free will, and they'd of course have to therefore have the freedom to do evil, and if some of them were supernatural creatures, they could explain any natural evil that happened in this possible world, then of course it would be possible that there be evil in this world that God could not possibly prevent, given that he's trying to achieve this obviously good goal of creatures with the significant freedom and the values that follow from it. So all he's painting is a logically consistent picture of the world. He's kind of pointing out that if you add the proposition, you know, this is one possible good reason that a God might have for allowing there to be evil, the significant value that attaches to free will and the things it permits, then that would prove that God and evil can coexist if this third element of the picture were true, which it might not be, you know. So it's not question begging. Yeah, excellent question to put your finger on there. So as Michael Bergman puts it, there is now, nowadays, nearly unanimous agreement among both theistic and non-theistic philosophers of religion that the logical version of the argument from evil does not work. It is a busted flush, and the argument in the philosophy of religion has, on the whole, whether you're talking to an atheist philosopher of religion or an agnostic philosopher of religion or a Christian philosopher of religion, moved on from this argument. So we'll move on from this in a moment, unless there's any questions on that before we do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
William Lindgren says that there's a handful of people still arguing in this direction, quite alone.
Mm.
Do you know who those would be?
So William Lane Craig, we're told, says that there are a handful of people who still try and defend the logical problem of evil. I quoted from Sam Harris, for example, although he's got some background in philosophy, his main training is in sciences. He's still clearly advancing that argument. So it's not that you can't find anybody who thinks this is a decent argument. It's just that the majority opinion of the field, including the majority opinion of, say, atheist philosophers and agnostic philosophers, it's across the board, there's a general agreement that Plantinga's kind of response to the logical problem of evil shows that it doesn't work. And I've quoted from various philosophers, including ones like Mackey, who were instrumental in trying to construct and sort of firm up this intuition, if you like, that there's some contradiction between God and evil, and Leprovda, who constructs, I think, a very good version of it, who both then admit, actually, it doesn't really work. It doesn't do the job that they wanted it to do. And so that's why the discussion has moved on. And it's not that atheists have no objections to God from evil, as we see, it's just that they've abandoned, on the whole, the claim that God and evil are incompatible, such as the obvious reality of evil conclusively disproves the claim that there's a God. And the evidential problem of evil is now where all the discussion in this area is really, really at, as it were. So the typical atheistic claim today is not that evil disproves the existence of God, but rather that evil counts against the existence of God, or counts against the rationality of belief in God. It's evidence in the no camp's favour to be considered, but it's not conclusive, knockdown evidence in the no camp's favour. And if we were to sketch out, well, obviously there are various versions here, I'm simplifying somewhat for our sake, but the general kind of schema of this kind of evidential or inferential argument from particular evils, sometimes people go from particular types of evil or how much evil there is in the world, say, would go something like this. Premise one, I don't see a good reason why God would do or allow X, some particular example of evil or the overall amount of evil or what have you. I don't see a good reason why God would allow X, or a reason that seems plausible as to why God would actually. I can admit some logically possible reasons, maybe. Okay, Plantinga's defence is logically possible, but it doesn't seem to me to be an actually good, plausible reason as to actually why God allows evil. Premise two. If I can't see a good reason for God doing or allowing X, there probably isn't one. Three, therefore, there's probably no good reason why God would allow or do X. Four, but unless there is a good reason why God would do or allow X, God doesn't exist. Five, the conclusion, therefore, God probably doesn't exist. So the conclusion here now is the more tentative God probably doesn't exist, rather than God definitely doesn't exist. Let's take a look at some of the moves that the argument goes through. I have here a picture of a lamppost illuminating the street around here. And there's a joke that sometimes gets told in this context about the Bob in the Beat coming across the drunkard at night who's scrabbling on his hands and knees on the floor around a lamppost. And the Bobby sort of asks, you know, what are you doing, mate? Don't know why suddenly an Australian Bobby, but he says, what are you doing, mate? And the drunkard replies, I've lost my keys. I'm looking for my keys. And the Bobby says, well, I assure you, you know, when did you last have them? Do you remember where you were when you lost them? And the drunk says, it wasn't here, it was somewhere else. Bobby says, well, what are you doing looking here then? The drunkard says, well, this is the only place I can see. Our knowledge of reality as finite beings is somewhat limited. Okay? The second premise of that argument that we looked at was, if I can't see a good reason for God to do or allow some evil or amount of evil, then there probably isn't a good reason. And that shift from our inability to perceive a reason that justifies God acting in a certain way to the conclusion that therefore probably God doesn't have a reason, there probably isn't a reason that God could have, seems to be a bit suspect in light of our knowledge of our limited knowledge. One of the things that we know within our limited scope of knowledge is that our scope of knowledge is limited, particularly in comparison with an omniscient God's scope of knowledge. So Gregory Gansel says, the inference from the claim that it seems as though there's no sufficient reason to be found for evil, to the conclusion that it's probably the case that there is no sufficient reason, is not a strong inference, at the very least. There are various analogies that help bring this out quite usefully, I think. Alvin Plantinga points to, this is one of William Blake's illustrations for the book of Job. When God replies to Job at the end of Job, and this is how contemporary and up-to-date in philosophical terms the book of Job in the Bible is, God doesn't tell him what his reason is for permitting the sufferings that Job has been through. Perhaps Job couldn't so much as grasp or comprehend those reasons. Instead, God attacks the implicit inference from Job's not being able to see what God's reason is to the notion that probably he, God, has no reason. He does this by pointing out how vast is the gulf between Job's knowledge of reality and God's. That list at the end of Job of some 50 or so questions about, well, the nature of the material reality around Job himself. You know, were you there when the earth was established? Do you know where the storehouses of the wind are kept? And so on. Now, obviously, a lot of that's couched in poetic language and couched within the scientific framework of the day. But the central point holds valid, doesn't it? That we know relatively little about the nature of the world compared to what God would know if there's a God. And indeed, in science, we tend to actually think that the more we find out about reality, the more questions that it raises. Every new thing that we discover raises another half a dozen research questions that we need to look into. Or the analogy, I like this analogy of the novice and the grandmaster. Supposing a novice and a grandmaster are playing chess, and we're as relatively novice chess players ourselves, we're not grandmasters. I presume, any grandmasters in the room? No? Okay. We're watching them play this match, and the grandmaster at chess makes a move, and the novice makes a move and takes the piece that the Grand Master had just moved. And maybe that piece that the Grand Master just moved was his queen. And we at least know this about chess. Queens are really valuable pieces. You know, it starts out with the pawns, with the poor old foot soldiers, and you work your way up to the king, and the queen is right there, kind of near the top of the list. The Grand Master's just moved his queen, and the novice has taken the Grand Master's queen. And we think, what a rubbish move! I can't see any good reason why that Grand Master moved his queen like that and lost it. He must be rubbish, yeah? But of course, maybe the Grand Master has deliberately made that move because, unlike the novice, he is thinking 20 moves ahead in the game and knows that he has just suckered the poor old novice into his trap, which he's about to spring in 15 moves' time. You see? Because the Grand Master knows what he's doing better than the novice and than us. If we were to make the judgment, I can't see a good reason for that apparently awful move. Therefore, the Grand Master probably doesn't have a good reason. We're on shaky ground, aren't we? Now, if you like, if the cognitive difference between you and God is perhaps a little bit greater than the cognitive difference between you and a chess grandmaster when it comes to chess, then perhaps we're on equally shaky ground, moving from I can't see a good reason why God did that to the conclusion that, well, he probably doesn't have one, does he? Very interesting recent example that brings out the point about a creator and his creation, and how people can misunderstand it or fail to grasp what's going on, came out with Michael Ward's research on C.S. Lewis's Narnia Chronicles. And over the years, various critics of literature have said that the Narnia Chronicles, okay, you can see that there's a kind of fairy tale angle level of them, and there's a sort of Christian allegory level, although Lewis hated the term allegory. They're not allegories, they're imaginations of what would happen if the gospel were incarnated in this fantasy world. But they've said there's various sort of elements that seem a bit sort of hodgepodgey and random, and, you know, why are there lots of dragons in Voyage of the Dawn Treader but not elsewhere? Why is Father Christmas turning up in Narnia, in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe? Father Christmas in a world where there isn't a Christ that, you know, Aslan, they know about. How do they know about Christ? That just seems a bit, And Michael Ward, particularly his book, The Narnia Code, which is the sort of shorter version of his PhD thesis on this, says this: how can characters in Narnia know of Christmas and Father Christmas when they show no knowledge of a character called Christ? They know about Aslan. It looks like a mistake. And various critics over the years, and he quotes them, have kind of hauled up Lewis on this and say, oh, he's just throwing stuff in because it's fun and it's sort of not really a coherent world. And J.R.R. Tolkien, famously, was very into his idea of sub-creation, and you have to go into, you know, creating your geography and the languages for the imaginary people in your world and go into real depth to give it this sense of reality. Didn't really like the Chronicles of Narnia because he thought it wasn't a proper act of sub-creation. Well, the Narnia series, says Michael Ward, I now started to see, having been reading one of Lewis's poems about medieval views of the planets, was a literary equivalent of Holst's Planet Suite. Each one of the seven heavens in medieval astrology, which in medieval astrology, because that was a sort of Christian-tinged astrology when astrology wasn't really separated from astronomy yet, of course, had Christian imagery and associations that had been piled on top of them. Each one of the seven heavens gave the key in terms of the themes and the contents of one of the seven Chronicles of Narnia. If Lewis, for example, was indeed writing his first Narnia Chronicle in order to express Jove's spirit, the planet Jupiter, which, for example, with its big red spot, which the medieval astrology associated with the wound in the side of Christ, where he was pierced with the spear, the jovial personality We still use that word in English to say, oh, he's a jovial fellow, sort of rambunctious and so on. We can see why he was so keen to keep Father Christmas in the story, even though on the face of it, Father Christmas doesn't belong there. Sometimes a storyteller will do what seems illogical on the surface because he knows of a deeper logic going on underneath. If you haven't, and this is a quote from Lewis, grasped the real and inward significance of the work as a whole, you know, Lewis was immersed in the literature of the Middle Ages and ancient literature, and was a literary critic and so on, so he was very into this kind of stuff. He was an amateur astronomer himself. Then this logical thing will look like, quote, a mere botch or failure of unity. Once we see that Jupiter's imagery, from the medieval view of this thing, is the inward significance of the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, we see that Father Christmas is not a botch. I refer you to Michael Ward's book, The Narnia Code, or Planet Narnia, the bigger version, to really bear that out. He's very convincing on this. But what about premise four of our inferential argument? Unless there is a good reason why good would do or allow X, God doesn't exist. I.e., if God exists, no evil can be gratuitous. That is, not directly attached to some reason that justifies God in allowing it to exist. There has to be some direct connection between every example of evil and preventing a greater evil or permitting an outweighing good. This is the idea that's lying behind premise four of our argument. Peter van Inwagen has a very interesting objection to this argument. I'm not sure, actually, to be honest, whether I'm 100% sold on this, but I think there seems to be something in it. It's certainly an interesting issue to think through. And he comes up with what he calls the vagueness argument for moral gratuity. And he says, think about this. A sentence of 10 years punishment for some crime is surely no more effective at deterring crime than a sentence of 9 years and 364 days. You know, how many people are not, you know, going to give up a life of crime because of that extra day? Or are going to avoid committing a crime because of that extra day on a sentence of 9 years, 364 days punishment for doing X, Y, or Z? Vagan continues, if no gratuitous evil is ever permissible, then a just punisher wouldn't sentence the criminal to 10 years. But this argument could be reiterated ad infinitum without end until we conclude that no jail term is just. But surely some jail term or other is just. It is just to punish criminals. The solution to this paradox is to recognise that effective deterrence for criminals, punishment for criminals, is a somewhat vague thing. A perfect moral judge must simply draw a line of demarcation somewhere, and of course for any place that he just decides to draw that line, it will be true that his drawing it at a slightly different place would have been just as effective. I mean, what criminal is going to avoid doing the crime or reform his life because of that extra second on his sentence, whatever it was? So Van Vagen says there is no precise number or quality of evil things that must occur to secure at least certain examples of compensating goods. Say, protecting society and reforming criminals and so on. Or preventing equally bad or worse consequences. A quote from Vagan, he says, God cannot remove all evil from the world now, for that would frustrate his plan for reuniting human beings with himself, one of the great goods permitted by human free will. And if he prevents only some evils, how shall he decide which ones to prevent? How would God decide when to step in to limit evil and when not to? Where shall he draw the line? Wherever he draws the line, it will be an arbitrary line, argues Invagen. Even God must draw an arbitrary line when deciding what number and quality of evil things to allow happening, therefore. So if there's no non-vague demarcation that can be drawn between evils that are absolutely necessary to secure some compensating goods or prevent worse evils, and B, evils that aren't necessary in this way, then any moral agent, including God, who was attempting to secure those compensating goods or prevent those greater evils, must actually make an arbitrary choice. And so the assumption underlying premise 4 of the inferential argument also seems to be false when stated as an absolute. There's a weakness in the argument there.
Yeah. The second paragraph says, but cannot remove all evil from the world now, for that would frustrate his plan. How would that be?
Okay, well, Plantinga is assuming the same kind of view of human freedom as Plantinga is in the free will defense. So he's assuming libertarian free will. He's assuming what's called incompatibilism, that is, the idea that the kind of freedom that is morally praiseworthy or blameworthy, the kind of freedom that's linked to responsibility and the values that that's attached to, like freely choosing to respond to the love of God and his offer of salvation, is incompatible with the claim that everything you choose is determined in some way, is not your responsibility, under your control or free control, that you don't actually have genuine options before you. And if that is the case, of course there's a whole discussion goes on there even within Christian circles about whether that's the case, let alone in philosophical circles more broadly, then you might be able to then say having that kind of free will is a necessary precondition of really good things like love, not only between people but between people and God, rather than us just being God's puppets, as it were, for genuine relationship to be possible. So that's the connection and the sort of underlying view of agency that he's drawing on. Yeah. So both premises 2 and 4 of the evidential argument are at the very least questionable. At the very least, they have significant weaknesses to them. And that means that at the very least, the argument as a whole is not very strong. Even if you think there's something to it, it's not very strong as an argument. Maybe those flaws are fatal to it, maybe they're not. You know, that's perhaps we'd have to go into more depth and think about it longer and so on. But I think at the very least that shows that the argument as it stands is not really going to do what the atheist wants it to do. But there are a couple of additional general responses that the Christian or the theist can make here. Again, I'm going to quote from an agnostic and an atheist on this point, because I like doing that. They're not biased towards my view, and they admit this. Agnostic Graham Oppie says, if theists can reasonably suppose that they have lots of evidence which supports the claim that God exists, then they may reasonably believe that there is a solution to the problem of evil, even if they don't know what the solution is. He's basically saying, given that it's obvious to you that there is evil, but it's also clear to you that there is a God, you think you can justify both of those claims, then clearly they must be able to coexist, even if you can't actually do anything to explain how they coexist. Atheist Michael Tooley, in a recent debate book with Alvin Plantinga, he's a really sophisticated proponent of the evidential problem of evil, perhaps one of the best atheist defenders of this argument there is today. He says the evidential argument from evil is, quote, highly controversial, even if it can be shown that the evils that are found in the world render the existence of God unlikely, it might still be the case that the existence of God is not unlikely, all things considered. For perhaps the argument from evil can be overcome by appealing either to positive arguments in support of the existence of God, or to the idea that belief in the existence of God is what philosophers call properly basic, that is, something it's reasonable to hold to just on the basis of your experience of reality. A bit like Job, at the end of Job, saying, you know, I'd experienced this evil, and I'd been talking a lot of stuff about God, but now I've met God. That which I'd only heard of, now I have experienced. I experience evil in my life, I experience God in my life. Ergo, God and evil must fit together in some way. Do I have to go further than that and be actually able to give some account of how they do? Well, that would be nice, but do I have to do that to still be rational in believing in God? Atheist Michael Tooley says, well, perhaps not. So if we're putting evil, as it were, as the main point, let's remember again, in the sort of balance pan against God, we also have to look at the other balance pan to work out what we think overall about the rationality of belief in God. And actually, there are very few arguments for atheism, but there are a load of arguments for theism. There's just a few of them. Alvin Plantinga once wrote a paper called 24 or so arguments for the existence of God. Now, of course, arguments for God tend to point to different aspects of God. They connect, make a connection between some aspect of reality and some aspect of God, generally speaking. There are very few that try and do the thing all in one, as it were, in charades. The ontological argument tries to do it all in one. Maybe Thomas Aquinas' argument from Beauty tries to do it all in one. But at least I would say there is a strong cumulative case pointing towards a belief in God. And I actually think the ontological argument and the argument from Beauty are good arguments as well. But those would be topics for an entirely separate section of lectures. But you get the idea that even if you think evil does count somewhat against belief in God, but what are you comparing it with in the other balance pan to come to an overall viewpoint? Also, when atheists state that evil exists in advancing the problem of evil of whatever sort, do they mean a subjective value, that's subjectively evil, like I dislike spinach, but you love it, that's just our subjective preference, or do they mean it's an objective value? Seems to me that in order to carry any kind of argument from evil, they've really got to mean an objective value rather than merely a subjective one. If they have a subjective concept of value, the argument from evil has no traction. If they mean an objective value, on the other hand, they're halfway through the moral argument for God already. Because one of the premises of the moral argument for God is that there are objective values. Now, it doesn't really matter whether that objective value is something that's objectively good, that you use as an example. Loving your neighbour is a good thing, so there's at least one thing that really is good. Or something evil. Torturing small children for the fun of it is evil. Objectively evil. But that's an objective value. What's the objective standard by which that value is measured? How do you explain the existence of such a thing as an objective demand upon us, an objective obligation for us to behave in a certain way? If you're going to try and fit such a reality in a naturalistic, atheistic worldview, to whom are you objectively obligated? Who is objectively prescribing your behaviour would seem to have to be a person, a personal reality of some kind. I can't be obligated to the chair. I can't be obligated to my evolutionary past of my species that may have operated to give me certain feelings about torturing small children for fun. You know, that I feel like I should avoid it. But is that feeling reflecting anything true about reality? Well, if objective moral values are there, if moral values are objective things, you'd want to claim that it's actually true that you should try and avoid torturing small children for the fun of it. but I can't be obligated or prescribed to by an impersonal reality, only a person. And yet these moral values that we're talking about seem to transcend even the obligations or commands that I might receive or owe to my peer group, my nation, the United Nations. If you think the United Nations could ever be wrong about anything, morally speaking, then you can't ground moral value absolutely objectively in what they happen to decide or think or feel. Only an absolute transcendent but personal reality can coherently ground the concept of objective value, by which to judge anything as objectively good or evil. And so there's a sense in which throwing the boomerang of the moral, the evil problem at the theist kind of rebounds, at least somewhat, on the atheist who throws that out there. It's J.L. Mackey again, famously said, if there are objective values, they make the existence of a God more probable than it would have been without them. Thus, we have a defensible argument from morality to the existence of God. Simply that as an atheist, he then went on to say, well, of course, if we believe that moral values are purely subjective, we don't face this problem. So I'll be a subjectivist. Seems to me the question then is, which is really the bigger problem? Having to believe in a God? Or having to believe that torturing small children for fun is not, objectively speaking, wrong? Well, I know which side I'd throw my hat in with on that question. So, if I could have a reminder of how we're doing for time, that would be useful. And
I saw 30 minutes. Well, 25 minutes.
25 minutes, okay. So, any questions on the inferential problem of evil and those more general responses to any argument from evil that I've kind of put out there for you?
So, my question about Sam Harris, how would they answer what is actually good, what is evil?
Right. Okay, so coming back to Sam Harris, the new atheist who claims to be an objectivist about moral values, what account of them does he give? Well, he thinks that you can define objective moral values in purely scientific terms. And if you want to go into this at more depth, then let me again recommend this debate that's happened recently between Sam Harris and William Lane Craig. Craig did an excellent job in the debate, and Sam Harris basically completely abandoned engaging in any of the arguments or issues after the first round and just talked red herrings for the rest of the debate, which was fascinating, if a bit frustrating. Harris kind of says in his book, The Moral Landscape, really intense suffering, people having really intense suffering, is obviously something that's really bad. Okay? We can use empirical methods, scientific methods, to notice when people are going through really intense suffering. We can kind of observe that. Therefore, evil is this really intense suffering that humans have. That's what evil is. So the move here is from saying suffering is evil to saying evil is nothing but suffering. Those are two different statements. Since we can observe suffering, and that's empirically obvious to us, then we can have a science of morality, and we don't need to appeal to anything metaphysical or beyond the material world to explain objective moral values. So it seems to me that making that shift is just illegitimate. He avoids, doesn't really engage with the classical problems of moving from a descriptive is to a prescriptive ought, doesn't really engage with that issue of where do you get the obligatory or prescriptive nature of moral obligation or moral law. It just kind of sidesteps all of that discussion from David Hume, G. Moore, through to the present day, and makes this shift of his, and says we can talk about morals objectively just through science, which is something that even most atheists disagree with him about. He seems to be in a very minority position there, even within his own camp. So people, Richard Dawkins has famously said that the world, as we observe it, is just as we would expect it to be if there is no designer behind it. And I quote, and he says, "No good, no evil, nothing but pitiless indifference. The physical world just is and does its stuff according to the laws of nature. And if you get in the way of those laws, you'll get hurt. Bad luck. You won't like it." That's all that can be said about suffering.
One more question.
Sure.
The set of arguments you described right now is always metaphysical in the sense that it is a very intellectual understanding of the meaning of God. Can we transfer this theistic position to the God that who describes himself, who reveals himself in the Bible throughout a very complicated complex history? Yeah. So, as let's say Aquinas argues, all call this God when he tries to prove God on his cosmological way, to identify the metaphysical understanding of God with the revealed understanding of God.
Okay, interesting question about the match-up or lack of match-up between what's sometimes called the God of the philosophers. Right. Pascal called it the God of the philosophers and the God of Revelation.
Right.
Now, my opinion on that is that they are indeed one and the same being. That both the philosophical and the revelatory roots, as it were, are legitimate roots to knowing, partially knowing about God, because through neither either or both roots do we comprehend God, but I think we can understand something of God through both roots, and we get a more rounded picture through putting both roots together. The revelation gives us data that we wouldn't have had to work on, to understand, without the revelation, and personal experience would be included within that as well. But it seems to me clear that the kind of being that you end up with in the project of natural theology, holy good, caused the universe, first cause, self-existent, at the very least very intelligent, if not all-knowing, purposeful, so on and so forth. You build up a sort of identikit picture through various different arguments. The ontological argument, as I mentioned, tries to do it all in one and says there is a maximally great or maximally beautiful, I like expressing it that way, being. But the God revealed in the Bible is a God who is said to, I am that I am. I'm the only thing that is pure existence, as it were. I am good, holy. I am purposeful. I know. I'm personal rather than impersonal. I do command you to behave in certain ways and not to behave in other ways. You are obligated to me. I own the earth and everything that's in it. And I'm the source of your life. So the things that we find out about God through revelation seem to be pointing, as it were, in the same bearing as the natural theology arguments. And I think what we're doing in theology as an overarching Christian discipline is trying to understand the world through everything we think we know as Christians, from whatever source we think we know it. And those sources include the actions of our minds created in the image of God upon all sorts of data, some of it in history, some of it in experience, some of it in sciences, some of it in philosophy, and so on. and we try and integrate that together. So that would be my take on it. So let's look finally back again to the kind of existential angle that I started with, because, you know, all of that's all very well and good when you're having a sort of common room discussion about, oh, well, how can you believe in a God when there's evil in the world? But we all know that there's more to the problem of evil than these intellectual issues. So Alvin Plantinga puts it very nicely when he says, most atheist thinkers have given up the idea that the existence of sin and suffering is logically incompatible with theistic belief. It has proven surprisingly difficult, however, to give a plausible statement of a probabilistic, the inferential, argument from evil. And as these arguments become more complex, like the sort of Ptolemaic system of the universe getting more and more complex as they added more and more epicycles to fit the data, it becomes less and less convincing, more and more ad hoc, less and less strong as an argument, as a viewpoint. Suffering and misfortune, Plantinga goes on, may constitute a problem for the theist, but the problem is not that his beliefs are logically or probabilistically incompatible or in tension. The theist may find a religious problem in evil. In the presence of his own suffering or that of someone near to him, he may find it difficult to maintain what he takes to be the proper attitude towards God. He may be tempted to rebel against God or even to give up belief in God altogether. But this is a problem of a different dimension. Such a problem calls not for philosophical enlightenment, but for pastoral care. There's a time and a place for getting out the symbolic logic to show the flaw in the atheist's argument from evil against the rationality of belief in God, and there's a time for getting out the kettle and a cup of tea and a hug and so on. I think a lot of the issues in this area boil down to what we think or indeed feel, as it were, about this question. Is the pain worth the gain? Saying no, the pain of our existence is not worth the gain, means saying that if humanity were threatened with extinction and it was within our power to save it from extinction, we ought not to do so. We're saying it would have been better if humanity had never come to pass. It's saying to oneself and to one's neighbour that life isn't worth living. My life is not worth living. Your life isn't worth living. That's what you're really saying when you're saying, I think the pain's not worth the gain. It is, in other words, to embrace an attitude of nihilism about reality. Let me illustrate this point at a sort of more intuitive gut level with a couple of clips from Luc Besson's film, sci-fi film, The Fifth Element. It's a fantastic sci-fi movie, if you like that kind of thing, and I do, by the French director Luc Besson, and it has a bit of a weird plot, but all you need to know, really, is that there is an evil force threatening the destruction of humanity in the future, and there is a piece of technology built by an alien race that can save us. To make it work, you have to have all five elements, bits of this machine, in place. You know, earth, wind, fire, air, water, the fourth. And the fifth element is actually a person, a genetically engineered super being in the shape of Mila Jovovich, who escapes from the humans who want to capture her and study her, and falls into the cab driven by taxi driver Bruce Willis in a string vest. Okay? Now, towards the climax of the movie, they're just going to get to the machine where they need to save humanity and everything to be in place and all work. But throughout the film, this super being, the fifth element, called Lilu, has been studying humanity, going through the Wikipedia, encyclopedia, as it were. And She gets to the entry for war. And let me turn up the volume on here so you can hear how this goes. So finding out about man's inhumanity to man kind of breaks the fifth element, breaks her heart, and it's kind of going to stop her from working. But I'll show you a second clip. They've got her into the building where this big alien machine is, and they need her to work. Is humanity going to be saved from the brink of destruction, or will Lilu's knowledge of man's inhumanity to man mean that we all end up extinct? At which point, of course, the entire cinema audience groan and say, oh no, what a terrible ending. It really would have been so much better had humanity been exterminated. Because after all, the pain of human existence is just not worth it, is it? No. The entire audience breathes a sigh of relief and a sense that things have come to their right and proper conclusion, and that Lilu's discovery of the reality of love correctly makes her think that actually it is worth saving humanity. And we intuitively agree with that, and millions of francs of filmmakers' money was invested banking on the audience sharing that intuition. The belief that the existence of humans is worthwhile reinforces the point that it's irrational to discount God on the basis that we don't have a complete answer to the question of why life is worthwhile. Without knowing exactly why the pain is worth the gain, I think we do nonetheless know that the pain is worth the gain. There are, I think, a lot of things that could be said in the field of theodicy. You could obviously link that clip to things about free will as a theodicy. But just to even reinforce the intuitive, properly basic belief that the pain is worth the gain, even though we might not have a complete explanation, I think is very significant. Now, of course, sadly, there are people who do come to the conclusion that the pain is not worth the gain, at least that the pain of their own existence is not worth it. And, you know, it's obviously very tragic and very sad if, in particular, if you know anyone who's committed suicide because of that. But the rest of us looking from the outside in on that situation, of course, we, even though we see that tragedy, we're also having this intuitive sense that it's tragic that they came to the conclusion that they ought to try and end it all. That there must have been something tragically wrong with their perspective on existence. And we must have that intuition, because otherwise the rest of us would all be joining them. And we don't. Even when we're in the midst of the context of the tragedy of someone taking their life because they think that the pain's not worth the gain. So in the very heart of the tragedy itself is a reinforcement of our intuition that actually, however so it may be the case, it is the case that the pain must be worth the gain. And indeed, recognising the value of human life means, as it were, making the unselfish decision that we'd rather the universe contain the value that we as creatures embody, even if that means the universe accepting, but not acquiescing in, suffering. We'd rather that be the case than not. And choosing to live that way is itself something we think is an unselfish, valuable thing, as it were. It might be a heroic thing in some cases that we would say is morally valuable. Maybe this unselfishness in the face of suffering is itself one of the values permitted by our existence that justifies our existence. Maybe that's part of the package of things that actually justify our existence. This is atheist Paul Kurtz writing from a secular humanist viewpoint, and he says, if secular humanists are to effectively provide alternatives to traditional theistic religions, we need to confront directly the root existential questions to help people withstand the blows of outrageous fortune. How do you get those resources from this worldview? We are children of chaos, says Peter Atkins, and the deep structure of change is decay. At root, there's only corruption and the unstemmable tide of chaos. Gone is purpose. All that's left is direction. This is the bleakness we have to accept as we peer deeply and dispassionately into the heart of the universe. A secular worldview, naturalistic worldview, has no resources to help us cope with suffering and to take that unselfish decision with any hope at all. I'd like to end with playing a clip from Gary Habermas. Now, Damaris interviewed him ourselves, and this is freely available on YouTube and so on, so it's fine to video this. I've noticed you folding the video away when I've been playing film clips, and that's probably right, but this one would be fine to put out there because it's out there anyway. So let me say that. If you do have to disappear, I'll understand because it's 22, but this is to say, I don't know exactly how long it is, but I interviewed Gary Habermas on this issue, and he's a great scholar on the resurrection of Jesus, but he's also someone who's been through the tragedy of losing his first wife to cancer. And I interviewed him on what is the connection that he would draw between his academic research on the resurrection of Jesus and his experience of going through the pain of losing his wife. And it's just a really affecting but also deeply Christian and hopeful view of coping with suffering. So I hope you'll find this encouraging.
You know, there are times when I wished I could move away from strict evidence, and talk about how the resurrection is applied to everyday life. I mean, to give you, for me, certainly the most central illustration, I refer to my wife, Debbie, and her death in 1995 to stomach cancer. And we brought her home from the hospital, and she was up in the room sleeping for most of the day, and I had a child monitor up there, and I went out to sit on the porch, and I kind of had a discussion with the Lord, a make-believe discussion, what would the Lord say? And the discussion always went something like this. Lord, Debbie's only 43 years old, and I have these young children, and you did give me ministry. How can I take care of the kids and the clothes and the food? And Lord, while I'm on this subject, why is Deb dying? And I pictured the Lord saying back to me, Gary, you know, we've got something in common. I watched my son die. Now, at the time, I thought the only kinds of people who could share my pain, so to speak, were those who lost a spouse or a child. So this was an especially relevant response that I imagined God saying. And so when he said, I watched my son die, this sort of, I imagined it sort of shocking me, you know, sort of setting me back a little bit. And I'd say, yes, you did, didn't you? And he'd say, and so the father, sorry, he kind of moves into that gap, and God says, you know, I didn't rescue him from the cross, did I? Oh, no, you didn't. No, you didn't. You know, Gary died. I see what's coming, so I zip ahead and I picture my wife dying. I'm thinking, I can't deal with this. And he keeps coming, and he says, Gary, I watched my son die. Do you expect better treatment than my son received? Lord, I'm not worthy. No, Lord, you understand, I'm just hurting. I'm just hurting. He said, Gary, I understand. I watched my son die. And here's my promise. And generally, I think this is the promise in Scripture. I think generally God does not claim to take us from things. I think the claims, repeated claims in Scripture, our favorite verses, is to hold our hand through suffering. And he says, I was there for my son. Into your hands I commend my spirit, and I'll be with you. And that crushed me, because I realized if this comes out, that Debbie's going to die. And she did. So we kept talking. The Lord said, one more thing. What kind of a world is this? I said, I guess a world where you raise your son from the dead. What does that mean? Well, come on, Lord. Wasn't that was 30 AD. This is 1995. Why? And he says, Gary, you're avoiding the issue. Let's go back to my question. What kind of a world is this? It's a world where you raised your... But Lord, Debbie's up there. Gary. At this point, I picture I'm reaching down and sort of grabbing my shirt collars and pulling me up close. And he says something like this. I know you've only got a PhD, so I'm going to say this real slowly. Read my lips. If this is a world where I raised my son from the dead, it's the same world in 30 AD as it is in 1995. The world is the same. It's a world where I'll hold your hand through suffering, and one day you'll be together. As a card that was sent to me that was the most touching, I couldn't even repeat this card for probably a year. The card said, can you imagine what it will be like when one day you are in heaven and you'll be able to walk with your wife through the heavenly gardens, walking hand in hand? And I was unprepared for the Lord's answer, and I said, Lord, what are you saying to me? And he said, simple. I watched my son die. Do you expect better? No, Lord. What kind of a world is it? It's a world where you raise people from the dead. Hang in there. I'm going to be with you. But I'm not taking you from this one. And it crushed me. But that was an application of resurrection to my present needs. He hadn't promised to take me from, but he promised to hold my hand through. And it was strictly because of the hope of resurrection that we have a truth like St. Paul's, where he says we mourn, but not as those without hope. And I realized that mourning with hope, the hope of heaven, is way better than mourning without hope. And as painful as the lesson was, it's a lesson we learn from the resurrection of Jesus.
We don't mourn as those without hope. And as the words of Neil Morse's song say, on the dark side there is suffering, but in the end we'll know what we've been through, and we can look forward to that city in the sky. Amen.
Amen.